And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. Today we're going to talk to Dr. Jennifer Juan, who is a professor of English at Alabama, University of Alabama, and she is from Nova Scotia originally. She has written a great book called Shakespeare in Quebec, Nation, Gender, and Adaptation. And it's a terrific subject. I know our listeners, we need to talk more about our home issues and our home problems. And so we're going to spend time doing that. In the latter part of the program, we'll try to update ourselves on some of the issues around the world. We'll probably talk about Democratic Convention, the developments in Turkey and such. And again, what I can tell our listeners, you can find our programming, of course, on Facebook, / The Taylor Report. And I think we are joined now by Dr. Jennifer Juan. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thank you very much for being with us. Your book, Shakespeare in Quebec, Nation, Gender, and Adaptation, and it's published by the University of Toronto Press. I want to tell you, I'm biased off the top. I think it's a terrific book, and it's, of course, a work of scholarship, but the footnotes, for example, are fascinating, so I really hope that readers won't say, well, it's especially aimed at an academic audience. I think it's aimed at everybody.
Absolutely. I certainly hope everybody will read it
particularly
and not be put off by or scared by footnotes.
Now, you, I should tell our listeners, you're from Nova Scotia, from Shelburne, right?
I am. Shelburne, Nova Scotia.
So you are what we call good loyalist stock?
I am. It is. There's a sign when you enter town about it's a loyalist founding city.
Yeah. So your folks fought with the bad American Republicans to the south and stood them off and all that. And now you have, as a scholar, you find yourself talking about a part of Canada that has always been to this day, a problematic subject about what Canada is. And I guess it's inescapable. I'm going to have to say I think we're trying to once again to enter the breach to bring together the two solitudes. You are dealing with Shakespeare, who is on the banner of the English history. And as a matter of fact, you know, I guess that's one of their first resources when they when one talks about Britain or one talks about the empire, what are its values? Everybody points at Shakespeare. And by your account, Quebec has decided that, okay, and they've adopted him, and he's become a Quebec patriot somewhat. I want to ask you, let's start with the subject of Canada, the colony, and where Quebec fits. And the book really unfolds with the idea of understanding post-colonialism. That it, I suppose mm-hmm. we're talking about after World War II.
Yeah, absolutely. And to go back to what you mentioned about the two solitudes, that was absolutely my intent in writing the book, in fact. Because of someone from Nova Scotia, it's you grow up not knowing much about Quebec if you're born and raised outside of Quebec and don't speak French. So it really was like the idea was to make Quebecois theater, and specifically Quebecois rewritings of Shakespeare, accessible outside of Quebec to an Anglophone audience and to bring those solitudes a little bit more into dialogue with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, post-colonialism is important too, insofar as in English Canada, certainly myself coming from a loyalist town where you would have red coat reenactments and grew up, a fan of Shakespeare, who I actually discovered primarily through Wayne and Schuster on CBC.
I'm glad you mentioned that. In a way, I did too. I invite our listeners, please look at that. It rings a bell with a lot of people. Wayne and Schuster's altering, and I'm going to ask you what they were doing there, but adapting Shakespeare and causing people to really, I think, not only get a good laugh, but to actually think about it more.
I'm thrilled to hear that you say that resonates, because I'm actually writing an article about Shakespeare and Wayne and Schuster right now. That was actually what I was doing before we went on the air.
Well, we look forward to
that. So, yeah, it's a way to kind of bring Shakespeare to the masses in an accessible, vulgarized form. And in Shelburne, Nova Scotia, there wasn't cable TV where I was growing up, and the CBC and Wayne and Schuster were instrumental in that. And so one grows up with kind of a very colonialist approach to the world. And I have no problem kind of identifying as a colonial British subject who grew up with Shakespeare and Dickens and Mutiny on the Bounty and all of those kind of classics of British literature and British culture. And in Quebec, of course, it's very different, because that is whom they were, the nationalist movement is against insofar as...
They're sort of in the back of the crowd watching.
Yeah, kind of been there since the conquest, but otherwise... Yeah, not a focal point.
You make a very nice you examine some of the other colonies, and you point out that it's problematic for people who are not from the heartland or from mother country. I better say that deciding how they're supposed to approach this revered figure, and you give the example of Australia, New Zealand, each has a slightly different approach, and also you contrast India, and I was very struck by that. You say that in India, the empire taught reverence, like this is like a sacred document practically, and it was a very respectful approach. But at least in my understanding, you could explain further. But Australia. As they evolved after, I'm going to just arbitrarily say, post-World War II, they began to take on Shakespeare in a manner somewhat similar to Quebec. And there's a word, I got to ask you about this word, larrikinism. Is that it?
Yes, larrikinism.
What the heck is that?
It's a kind of derision or comic approach that comes out of the fact that Australia was, of course, a penal colony. And so for them, there's always been kind of a bit of a kind of rowdy, rebellious nature to the country and the colony as a whole, as a country that's founded by convicts, essentially. And so in as far as they... were always kind of anti-authoritarianism or anti-authoritarian. That the larrikin is their kind of way of rebelling against authority and doing so through kind of comic derision and send-ups of authoritative figures.
By the way, isn't that somewhat the nature of what, going back to Wayne and Schuster, the ability to mock is a liberating thing, isn't it? I mean, or to alter, if someone goes by and he's very proud, then if you walk along behind him with your chest out and make faces, I mean, it's...
absolutely. It's
good
for
your
psyche.
It's
a way of taking back power from those authoritative figures when you can mock them. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's kind of got this double-sidedness in that when you're mocking an authoritative figure, it's confirming that person or that figure is an authority. Otherwise, there would be no need to mock them in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
and so I think there's that kind of two-sidedness to it. And that is really comes out a lot in the Quebecois Shakespeare's and it comes out in their name for him, Le Grand Will. He's big. He's grand. He's a figure of authority. He's important. But he's Will, the guy you want to sit down with and kind of have a beer with at the bar and tell some jokes. And so he's got that double-sidedness to him here.
Yeah. Hey, I have to put in there, too. We're speaking to Dr. Jennifer Drouin, and the book is Shakespeare in Quebec, University of Toronto Press. It's Nation, Gender, and adaptation. This idea of Shakespeare as your friend, or somebody that you could befriend, as opposed to having him on a pedestal, is that this is something. I assume that's the Quebecers have decided this is how they wish to take him. Was there a reaction against that as they began to take up this approach? Did people say, wait a minute, you can't do that to Shakespeare?
I think it's more a question of you can't do that to Molière. And so Shakespeare, it's easy for Quebecers to do what they want to Shakespeare, to adapt him, to parody him, to change some sacred lines here and some sacred lines there, because those lines aren't sacred to them, because they don't know them. Insofar as most of the Shakespeare that Quebecers are going to get is already going to have been translated up until kind of the period that I start the book at, the Quiet Revolution, it would have been standard French translations coming from François Victor Hugo, and they would have been very kind of relatively straight and to the loyal to the Shakespearean text, but nonetheless they're going to be in French. And so other than kind of maybe a famous phrase like to be or not to be, it's not like a Quebec audience is going to have the words in the back of their head rolling off their tongue as they're watching a production, the way that an English Canadian audience can go to a Shakespeare play and suddenly notice, oh, they just cut out that important speech, or they skipped that, or they changed that word, because the words are, we have them kind of in our DNA almost.
Yes. Until the post-colonial times, it was we were Shakespeare and they were Molière. But with the Quiet Revolution, that all began to change. Although, if I read you rightly, Shakespeare is still not really the center or part of the general studies today. As you say, for example, you grew up with Shakespeare. They tap into him, but it's not a central part of the studies, is it, Shakespeare?
No, it's not. It's not part of the school curriculum in Quebec at all. The curriculum that's mandated by the Minister of Education. But from what I've been told, neither is Molière. Neither of the two are mandatory. And
I'm disappointed.
Perhaps an occasional. I am too, frankly. I think. And I recently heard that Shakespeare is no longer mandatory in Ontario high schools, and I found that kind of shocking and disappointing.
I'm ready to.
I guess individual teachers are allowed.
I'm ready to pick
it.
I did not know that. But by the way, wouldn't that open up the? If you were going to say, let's correct this, wouldn't it be awfully nice, wouldn't it, to make study of the, for example, I'm going to be asking you about this one, the Hamlet, Prince of Quebec. It'd be very good to study that play.
It would be wonderful to study that play, and in fact, I really hope that high schoolers and Cégep teachers and Ontario high school kids or whoever would, and it would be really interesting, I think, to read Hamlet side by side Hamlet Prince of Quebec. And actually, my dissertation supervisor, Leonore Weidland, published an anthology with Playwrights Canada Press, which is adapting Shakespeare in Francophone Canada, that has an English translation of the text. Mm-hmm. And I'm working with the University of Victoria Internet Shakespeare editions to produce critical editions of these plays for the web, so that anyone, or any school teacher who wants to assign it, could assign it, and it would be free on the web for students. Because right now, a lot of these plays aren't published, and it's a little hard for the teachers or the general public even to pick up a copy and read them.
Well, by the way, I apologize. I'm doing it almost backwards, but here we are. That's a dual text. My understanding is that from your book is that in 1968, I believe, the Hamlet, Prince of Quebec was performed, but not just in Quebec, in French, but it was also performed in English in London, Ontario.
Yeah.
So we have an English text
as well.
Version.
You have the English text.
Phenomenal.
The English text is different than the French text, because essentially it was re-translated. So the English is an adaptation of
an adaptation.
Yeah, rather than its own, because otherwise, if you were to translate it back, it would you wouldn't translate it back, and you wouldn't get Shakespeare. What you're going to get is an adaptation.
And the idea was pedagogical, right? That is, they thought that there were things the English audience had to be told so they'd understand the play.
Yeah, exactly. And so they changed some of the characters and some of the names and some of the lines to fit a London, Ontario audience rather than a Montreal audience. Yeah. First performed here.
Well, they were having to explain that some ugly things have happened. And certainly, ordinary student in Ontario doesn't know that the mayor of Montreal during World War II was locked up for 4 years.
No, I don't think that was.
Somebody has to tell them. They say, by the way, this happened. And they use a radio, I think, to do that. But let me ask you, to set the stage for why Shakespeare is so changed and so powerful in Quebec and as through this the medium of these plays. What was the Quiet Revolution? What happened? The dramatic shift that went on there. There was so many things, and the word revolution is appropriately used in my view. I know it was quiet, but it was, sir, a revolutionary change for the people of Quebec. Could you talk about some of the things that happened there?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a revolutionary change. And what's interesting about the term quiet revolution is here in Quebec, it's normally La Révolution Tranquille in French, and people tend to just assume that it's a French term. But it was actually an Anglophone journalist, I believe from Ontario, who coined the term to describe what was happening in Quebec, because looking at it from the outside,
there's a
so much kind
headline.
Of radical change that's happening kind of in a snowball that they were like, wow, there's a revolution going on over there on the other side of that border.
Yes, led by liberals, Lesage.
Yes, the Lesage liberals, which were the Liberal Party, but quite different from the Quebec Liberal Party that we know today. For starters, René Lévesque was part of the Liberal Party at the time, because this would have been before.
And what did they do to the education system?
Often created the PQ.
The education system was one of the first things they really went to work on, right?
The education system was a massive thing, the creation of the CEGEP, which only exists, I think, in Quebec, although I've heard something similar might exist in BC. The CEGEPs are essentially these two-year colleges after what would be the equivalent of grade 11 in Ontario and the first year of university. And they can either lead to a degree that allows you to go on to university, or if you do a three-year degree, they can lead to a trade of some sort. So those were really crucial in terms of raising education and literacy rates in Quebec, which up till then weren't so great, primarily because they'd spent all of these years ruled by Maurice Duplessis in what was called the Grand Noir Sur, the Great Darkness. So there was a great need to kind of catch up on the educational and the literacy front. So there was that. There was also the creation of the University of Quebec system. So most people are probably aware of University of Quebec of Montreal, or UQAM. But there's also all of the other universities in the system. So there's like University of Saskatchewan-Riviere. There's one at Rimouski. There's one in Outaouais on the other side of Ottawa and Gatineau Hall. So creating that whole network of universities was a really important thing that happened during the Quiet Revolution, too. Of course, there was the Metro was dug. Expo 67 was happening. This is kind of all kinds of massive changes. Of course, the healthcare system, know, moving away from essentially all of the social services up till that point were run by the Catholic Church.
A good opportunity to mention gender. By the way, we're speaking to Jennifer Drouin, Shakespeare in Quebec, Nation, Gender, and Adaptation, University of Toronto Press. People ought to ask their libraries right across the country to get a copy of this, because it's great history, contemporary history, brilliant. And in that fold-in of issues under the Quiet Revolution, gender, the status of women and others began to change, did it not?
It did indeed. That was a major change that happened. And what's interesting is when I started to kind of research this topic and write this book, I was struck by one particular call to arms or phrase, a catchphrase, mm-hmm. Which was essentially about the unification of the nationalist struggle and the feminist struggle, which was Pas de Québec libre sans libération de femmes, pas de femmes libre sans libération de Québec, which essentially meant no free Quebec without women's freedoms and no free women without the freedom of Quebec. Mm-hmm. And that made me kind of think, well, okay, how closely tied was the nationalist movement and the feminist movement? Because the Quiet Revolution started in the 60s. We really saw the feminist movement in Quebec and around, you know, the Western world kind of take off in the late 60s, early 70s. And so I kind of expected them to be linked. And what I found out was actually they were not as linked as one would think. Mm-hmm. You know, politics.
And in the theater where you're Shakespeare, I noticed that you point this out time and again, women were not at the forefront in the dramatization. In the politics, they were.
In the politics to a certain extent. There were certainly important women in politics at the time. I think of like someone like Pauline Marois, who, you know, we think of her today as the first female prime minister of Quebec, but she was there like in the 60s and 70s, or someone like Louise Carrel. There were a lot of important mm-hmm. Women in the PQ in the early days. And the other thing that's interesting is how much of the kind of changes in laws that were progressive on in terms of gender and sexuality for both women and for queer people were passed by the PQ. So on the political front, there was this kind of convergence of nationalism and feminism, mm-hmm. but it's not something that was really kind of taken up to the extent that I initially expected it to be. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the authors that I studied in these Shakespearean adaptations were up until the 1990s. I didn't find a female author who had adapted Shakespeare. They were all men. And the plays were very nationalist focused, but they didn't incorporate that kind of feminist aspect that you were seeing on the political front or by the presence of women in politics.
Yeah. By the way, I noticed that reading the book, that there's as the flow of history, issues come and go. We had the Quiet Revolution. You have this issue of sovereignty association. And then of course, we had the referendums, the two, mm-hmm. and the theater that you're talking about is shifting and moving and playing a part. It's very interesting. It's like music in the background. They begin to talk about, they move the issues as these big questions come and go. But before we get, I want to ask you more about that, but just ask about this. I notice the term is used, the grandfather of the Shakespeare plays in Quebec. Is this play Hamlet, Prince of Quebec?
Yeah.
Which I want to ask you about because it's on the cover of the book is a terrific photograph, and it's Hamlet Quebec with his fleur-de-lis, and he's looking at a Rosencrantz or Guildenstern, I think, and who's wearing also fleur-de-lis, but underneath he notices he's actually got maple leaves. What a great story. Could you tell us what's going on in that play? On all who these, I loved it that Pierre Trudeau was Laertes, Pearson is Polonius, and boy, was there ever anybody chosen perfectly. And the ghost is Charles de Gaulle.
the pairing of the Hamlet characters with the political characters of the time is, I think it's absolutely amazing.
Isn't it brilliant?
And what's more amazing is that the play was performed in January 1968, whereas the PQ wasn't actually founded until
spring, right?
Yeah. And at the time of essentially Robert Gerick, the author of this play, had an incredible foresight and possibly a little bit of luck in picking which character in the political sphere to align with which character in the play. Because when he did it, the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern figures, on the cover it's Rosencrantz, who is Gérald Peltier. And if you remember from history class, they were called the three wise men in English, and in French we call them les trois colombes, the three doves.
Yeah.
So there was Gérald Peltier and Trudeau and the other one whose name is escaping me right now, Jean Marchand. And at the time, it wasn't clear who was going to emerge to take over as the leader of the Liberal Party and eventually Prime Minister of Canada, because this was before Trudeau became Prime Minister. And so it's maybe a little bit of luck and
prophetic,
maybe a little bit of kind of just good instincts and predictions that the people Gerrit Pipt ended up falling kind of perfectly into the parallel roles and structures that he designed to succeed and to choose that Trudeau would end up succeeding Pearson as Prime Minister 4 months after the play, and that Trudeau would be kind of the leader of English Canada.
Phenomenal.
The way that he's got it set up.
There must be somewhere in somebody's memoirs, they must talk about all this and say, did you really know that was going to happen? It's a prophetic. It's what a rollout for René Lévesque, that they're already, Hamlet is dying, and he turns to Horatio Lévesque and says, you got to do something.
Yeah, and he essentially leaves him with the task of taking up the charge, and René Lévesque as Horatio.
After the play, he picks up the mantle. I wonder if he saw this play. I wonder if he was aware of it.
I don't know. I just know this from having talked to the author himself, Robert Guérin, that, you know, at the time it wasn't known, and everything he kind of predicted turned out to happen.
Yeah. Just phenomenal. All these other characters fit so well. And we should say today is July 25th, one day following many years ago in 1967, Charles de Gaulle attending the Expo. I think he was at Expo, wasn't he? And he gave this speech where he said, Vive Québec libre, which nearly brought down the government. Certainly was a shock.
It certainly was a shock. And I don't think that, from what I've read about the event, it wasn't part of his pre-prepared speech. And they weren't expecting him to say it. And then there he is on the balcony of Montreal City Hall, and he sees this crowd waving flags, and he just gets caught up in the moment and utters his Vive le Québec libre, which in the play becomes the equivalent of Hamlet, the ghost of Hamlet's father, saying, remember me.
He's talking about the conquest, yes.
Yeah. And what's interesting is the ghost of Hamlet's father, remember me, is about looking back towards the past, whereas Vive le Québec libre is about looking towards the future. It really is kind of like a call to arms, which is, I guess, inciting Hamlet to take action, which is the whole problem Hamlet has in Shakespeare and Hamlet has in this adaptation as well, is spending too much time sitting around thinking and not actually doing anything. So the ghost here gives him an extra push.
Lévesque himself would, even though in this he's Horatio, but he could have easily been, in terms of his temperament, he could have been Hamlet, in that people always wondered, because of the necessity of the language, even in the Liberal Party, he was Sovereignty Association. That was his story from the beginning. It's which. And I guess the words in Hamlet, Prince of Quebec, his words are, Hamlet's words are, be free or not to be free. Is that
be
right?
Be free. Yeah. To be or not to be, I think there might be a dot, 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 free. As opposed to simply to be or to not to be, which totally changes it from a reflection on is my life worth living? Should I just commit suicide now? To a reflection on what do I need to do to take control of my life and free myself from what is, from this perspective, considered an oppressive political structure in which I'm not free and I'm being held back.
We're speaking to Jennifer Durand. She's very patient because we We're going to go longer than we had anticipated. This is a great subject. The book is Shakespeare in Quebec, Nation, Gender, and Adaptation. Now, you raise a topic which in the book about not just Quebec, but other, let's say, post-colonial nations that are not fully independent, and such as Catalonia, and there are other spots as well, places. And there's a question that comes up in these countries, nationalities, is, are they linguistically sufficient to take on Shakespeare and to express Shakespeare? Now, I know there was a rendering in Quebec of the story of Macbeth and what I think we're going to call Quebecois. And I thought I'd give our listeners a taste of this as introduced by a prominent Quebec singer, Robert Charlebois. If you could stay with us, we'll listen a bit to that, and you can explain this to us.
Okay.
Tout ça a commencé sur les plaines d'Abraham. La chicane t'a poigné, t'a mangé, t'a volé. Mais depuis ces temps-là, t'as pas beaucoup changé. Je te trouve bien magané, puis encore bien poigné. En deux joints, tu pourrais faire quelque chose. Juin, tu pourrais grouiller le cul. Ta soeur est aux États, ton frère est au Mexique. Ils font d'argent là-bas pendant que tu chômicites. T'es né pour un petit pain, c'est ce que ton père t'a dit. Chez les Américains, c'est pas ça que t'aurais appris. En deux joints, tu pourrais faire quelque chose. En deux joints, tu pourrais grouiller le cul. Faut que t'apprennes à marcher. Si tu fais comme ton père, tu vas te faire fourrer. Je sais que t'en as ce type, t'en as jusque-là. Et tu peux changer ça, vite ça presse en maudit. En deux joints, tu pourrais faire quelque chose. En deux joints, tu pourrais grouiller de cul. T'as un gouvernement qui te vole la tour de bras. L'homme pas le gouvernement, mais débarrasse-toi-en.
That's Robert Charlebois. And in the notes, and I told listeners, terrific footnotes. I could read them all day long, full of anecdotes and information. But the translation of what Charlebois was singing says, your sister's in the States, your brother's in Mexico. They make money there while you're unemployed here. You were born for a little roll of bread as opposed to a loaf. That's what your father said. With the Americans, that's not what you'd have learned. And now, is this in terms of, I was going to ask about Joao. Is this the place to mention it? Is tell us about him. And by the way, the co-author, maybe the author, I don't know. The words, I understand, were written by Pierre Bourgault.
Yes, Pierre Bourgault co-wrote the words, and he is he was the leader of the REN, which was a political party which was much smaller than the PQ and eventually merged and became part of the PQ. And he figures in Hamlet Passed to Quebec as a character because at the time he was an important political actor. And even after he was
a sidekick with the Levesque character, right? He appears in the scenes with him.
Yeah, he appears with Levesque. He is kind of
so
like
the author
Levesque's
was covering
sidekick.
His bets in terms of who would become the leader.
Exactly. Yes. And Pierre Bourgault remained really important as a writer and social commentator throughout his lifetime in Quebec. So he's
very colorful, wonderful individual to watch. Even though I did not understand the French, I could appreciate him just watching him.
Yeah, the language is very. I mean, if I were to translate some of the other bits that you didn't just translate. The song is about what you could do in between smoking two joints. So, and the phrase is "grouiller le cul," which means move your ass. So get up and move your ass, which is actually kind of very similar to Hamlet's problem as well you know, sitting around smoking joints, thinking about stuff instead of getting up and moving around and doing something.
Well, movement is good for the brain. They've told us that. What is it? Sitting is the new smoking.
It is.
Now, well, okay, so this dual, and the question of could Quebec French handle Quebec, Quebec Shakespeare? That was, and they produced a, was it Macbeth, where they used, let's call it Québécois?
Yes. Macbeth translated by William Shakespeare into Québécois by Michel Garneau, which came out in 78, which he had actually translated another play earlier, The Tempest, in 73, which got printed in 89. But yeah, he essentially wrote it in a kind of partial joual and partial fake 18th century dialect, going back to how he imagined people would have spoken during the conquest.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much a kind of, it's written to be spoken out loud and to be pronounced, and you really kind of have to speak it to get.
And to be frank, that's working, that's what we call working class French, right?
It is working class French.
That must have had mass appeal.
There's kind of still historical debate about what joual means. Some people say it comes from a mispronunciation of cheval, which means horse. But generally, it's working-class French. It's the kind of French that, you know, you go to the garage to get your car fixed, and people are kind of sitting around chatting, and it'll be that kind of French.
Well, now
rather
that must
than say what you listen to if you're watching or Radio Canada News or something.
That must really charm the audience to hear. Here they are looking at Shakespeare and hearing their own neighborhood language.
I would hope so, and I think that's the point and why Michel Garneau did that. And when he did that in the Macbeth play in 78, this was still 10 years after Michel Tremblay's Belle Sœur in 1968, which is the first and most important play, not a Shakespeare adaptation, but nonetheless in Quebec theater history, Les Belles Sœurs by Michel Tremblay was really the first play to ever put joual working class accents and language on stage, and it was a revolution. And it's, I mean, this is partly why it happened during the Quiet Revolution in the 60s. Is it was
maybe we should try that
allowing people to affirm their own identity again and to say, oh yeah, I can watch a play and recognize myself as opposed to recognizing foreigners from some other place who aren't really part of my reality.
Mm-hmm. Well, that I remember reading Gore Vidal many years ago, talking about attending Stratford, and he said, I really feel for this audience because they're at pains to understand a few words so that they can laugh.
Stratford, Ontario, or Stratford, England?
Pardon me?
Stratford, Ontario, or Stratford, England?
Ontario. Actually, he was attending one of the early, I hate to say that I'm that senior, but he was covering the Stratford for a magazine called The Reporter many years ago. And he had this little essay, and he was worried for the audience that they seemed to be in agony, that they couldn't make out all you know, the words. Had there been a form of English that they were more acquainted with, they might have comprehended more. And by the way, this is what you're getting at. These are adaptations, and again, some people feel sinful if they do that.
Although
not
it
me,
makes sense to render it in a way that is going to resonate with the audience. Mm-hmm. And actually, the Vidal comment about Stratford is kind of not surprising, because in the history of the Stratford Festival, it was founded by a British director, and the first kind of for many, many years, it was mostly British actors who were brought into Canada to kind of teach us for colonials, mm-hmm. how to do Shakespeare properly.
Yes.
And so I guess the difference with Quebec was, A, we didn't have the Stratford Festival, it's in another province,
mm-hmm.
and B, by adapting, there's no longer this need to constantly retranslate into proper colonial France from France, French from France.
Mm-hmm.
Might as well just like write it in our own dialect as we're going,
yeah, by the way,
and adapted along the way.
We could point that out too, that the this matter of Shakespeare in Quebec, they were confronting not only the idea of British cultural hegemony, but also French, because the Academy doesn't allow people to get out of line, is my understanding. The French Academy, they can be very punitive or certainly offended if you don't use the French that they regard as French.
Yeah, and that's
and so the Quebecers are thumbing their nose at them as well when they do this.
Exactly. So they're thumbing their nose at the Français de France that have to be very high-saluting and proper, and they're thumbing their nose at Shakespeare and British culture and, by extension, English-Canadian culture at the same time. So it's all part of this affirmation of Quebec culture and who we are and our language. And it's interesting the what you mentioned about the Français de France, because, of course, today, and even still, but especially in this time period of the 60s, 70s, 80s that I'm writing about, Français de France is seen as proper, standard, and Québécois is seen as inferior, which in fact isn't true, because the Québécois French, the joual, what we call joual today, part of it is actually the French that would have been brought here when they came and colonized New France prior to the conquest. So, for instance, in proper Français de France French, you would say moi, meaning me, but in Québécois France, French, you would often say in joual, moi, which is written M-O-E accent aigu, but the Québécois joual moi is actually the way that moi would have been pronounced in France at the time they settled New France. Isn't and it? So it's actually more French than the proper French.
Yes, that's like a friend of mine once was asking me about Canadian history, and I showed him some things, and he said, "Hey, what? That's the Royalist flag. What is that?" The fleur-de-lis. He said, "Don't they know about the French Revolution?" I said, "Well, I'm afraid they were separated by the colonialism and by the church. The church sealed them off, right?" From the French Revolution. So if the French want to know how French spoke, they'd have to go to Quebec.
They would have to go to Quebec, or even better, they could go to Acadie. I actually spent 6 years living with the Acadians on the French shore of Nova Scotia. Yeah. And that, too, was
in your territory.
Yeah, and that was a pocket of French that was protected from, it just simply didn't evolve from the time that they settled Acadia. To today, so they still conjugate their verbs the way you would conjugate your verbs in Rabelais' time, for instance.
There's no shortage of irony
French
in this business.
Go to Canada.
We're speaking to Dr. Jennifer Joanne. The book is Shakespeare in Quebec: Nation, Gender, and Adaptation, in University of Toronto Press. And again, I'm going to say to everybody, let's get all the libraries to get a copy, because it's great history, modern history. It's brilliant and subversive and all the good things. Another aspect. We haven't done enough on gender here, but I want to, before doing that, I want to mention that something else is striking here. That is that these playwrights, certainly in the early period, were identifying themselves with anti-colonial struggles in Africa. In one of the plays, Levesque comes off as they use him as a figure who is represents negritude, the idea from Senegal, and they're very insistent on it. I mean, they're in these plays, they make strong political identification and reference to struggles such as that in Ghana. And Nkrumah. And so we sort of forget that Quebec regarded itself at that period, certainly Levesque and others. I know that Levesque used to give lectures about Algeria. He was fascinated by Algeria, as was Jack Kennedy, now that I think of it. But he explained to the population of Quebec what was going on in Algeria. That seems to have been, well, at any rate, is that accurate, what I've been saying?
Yeah, that's totally accurate. It's really important in those texts from the 60s, especially this emphasis on kind of drawing the parallel between African decolonization in places like Algeria
and African Americans.
Yeah, and the need for Quebec to decolonize itself. And you see that in a lot of the other literature of the time period. So Pierre Vallière's famous book, Les Nègres Blancs d'Amérique, would be translated as White Niggers of America, although the word neg and nigger don't really translate. It's got a slightly different connotation in French, which is less
And his goal was to identification of the black struggle of America with Quebec.
Yeah, absolutely. To compare them, and that's why he makes that. And it's also very rooted in kind of a Marxist discourse about class struggle as well, because the Quebecers at the time were working class, and the Francophones were essentially being subjugated to Anglophone bosses. So you had this kind of contrast between the rich white Anglophones living in Westmount and the poor, also white Francophones in the rest of Quebec who were working for them. And to be a boss or to even be what's called a contremet, which is, I guess, kind of like a in between the boss and the worker. The foreman. You had to speak English.
Yes. You had to speak white.
Speak white. And so there's this notion of how language is tied to race in a way that's really weird because, of course, you know, these are white people, but who are kind of associated with the black struggle in the rest of America.
And the world.
And the world.
Yeah.
Especially in Africa.
Yeah.
And things like Franz Fanon's Black Skins, White Masks, and all these texts about decolonization in Africa are really kind of an inspiration here in Quebec at the time.
Now, by the way, people certainly here feel post-colonial, but Quebec, that cannot be over, right? I mean, this issue has to be a living issue today.
I think it still is today. I think anyone who is still part of the sovereignist movement would see us as still being in a kind of colonized state, and often you see it like on social media or wherever, an example of this being colonial or an example of that being colonial. It's constantly being phrased in those terms still today.
Very much like in Scotland and Catalonia.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is an unresolved issue of being masters in their own house.
Exactly. And even though it's been, you know, even though these plays were written in the 60s, as long as the issue is unresolved, those discourses are going to still keep coming up, I think.
Yeah, it's sort of, I don't know why I think of him, but Jack Kerouac in his last days, I understand, had returned to speaking French only.
That's really interesting, because I recently read that they discovered a precursor to On the Road that was written entirely in French.
Apparently, this gnawed at him because, of course, he was a Quebecer. He grew up in the U.S., but he understood himself to be a Quebecer. Spoke French until he was, I think, 12, 14 years old.
Yeah, and identified as such.
It was eating away at him in a way. Phenomenal.
Yeah.
And it's Jennifer Joanne. I haven't done enough on this issue, and I know it is something very crucial to the book. And this is a matter of gender.
Right.
These national movements tend to have a macho quality, but also there is the issue of gay rights and the role of these. Now we have all the letters to describe the various communities, but can you tell us how does that emerge in these plays or in the discussion in Quebec?
Yeah, that's, to me, that was really interesting because, like I said, I started off wanting to write the book assuming that I would find a lot of parallels in the text that would line up with what I was seeing happening in the historically or politically. And the gender in the plays just doesn't really emerge until after the 1990s. And a friend of mine, who I will give credit to this for, Aaron Wunker, pointed out that December 1989 was the Montreal Massacre.
Yes.
And that really kind of changed gender in Quebec, I think, at that time, in terms of really making people wake up to, oh my gosh, these women have been killed just because they're women trying to do what was traditionally a male job of being engineers.
Yes.
And so it's finally in the 1990s that you start to see plays, well, adaptations of Shakespeare written by women. It's not like there were never any plays in Quebec written by women. Certainly there were very important plays written in the 70s, like Les Filles en Soif, that were very, very feminist and very strong, but they weren't. So if you just look at the Quebecois adaptations, it takes until the 90s for feminist plays to start to emerge. And even then, to me, the plays that were written by women or that treat women's issues were not as resolutely feminist as I was expecting or hoping them to be. They kind of were in many ways very traditional, like the example in the book of The Making of the Macbeth, where the woman is kind of debating between having a career or having a baby and becoming a mother, as if the two weren't possible at the same time. And so I found that kind of disappointing, that I was hoping to find feminist plays and they just weren't there. Or Les Rennes by Normand Charette, who is a gay author who has written fabulous plays from a queer perspective. It writes Les Rennes, which is about the women in Richard III and ostensibly before that in the Henry VI plays as well. And it's
the
essentially
Queens.
Entirely, yeah, the Queens. It was translated by Linda Gaborio into English, so it's actually published and available in English as well. And you have an entire play about the Queens who are not really seen in Shakespeare, not given a chance to express themselves very much in Shakespeare, and they have this entire play to themselves, and you get to kind of imagine what they would say and do, and yet they don't come off in a positive light of it all. They come off as scheming bitches and murderers and backstabbers and, like, kind of not what I would expect from a feminist perspective.
You might have to write a play.
I might have to write a play. After studying adaptation so much, I do kind of have a sense of how I think certain Shakespearean plays should be adapted for today's day and age.
But, of course, now you tie this into the fact that, after all, these plays are all accepting the new recognized community of the Québécois, and that within that context, the issue of national identity, I hate to use the word trumps, but trumps gender and other issues. And I suppose that's... I read that as inevitable. I mean, if the national question is a national question, inevitably that's going to happen.
It's interesting because it's still like a tension that we're dealing with today in Quebec. So
yeah, you have a woman, by the way, is running for leadership, Yvonne.
We do, Véronique Yvonne, who I think is a great choice. She would be a wonderful leader of the PQ and a wonderful prime minister. She's got a she studied at McGill in law, and she really on the ball. She's the one who pushed through Dying with Dignity, the right to assisted suicide in Quebec. She wrote that law and brought everyone together. So there are important women in Quebec politics. And on the one hand, the fact that the national question is unresolved means that it's always going to be there until Quebec does become sovereign. I don't think it's ever going to go away, as much as people like to say, oh, the polls are going down, but there's always a way to find a poll that's going down, and then the polls have essentially been steady since 95, yes. hanging at about 40%.
Hire a different pollster, that's all. Find one.
Hire a different pollster. You can always get numbers to say something.
I know that when I travel to Quebec that French is there, and that is the reality. And there will be – this matter will remain until it's worked out, hopefully in a democratic manner.
Hopefully in a democratic manner. At the same time, this kind of focus on gender or focus on – anything else, like environmental issues, is kind of the struggle that the sovereignist movement is going through, because you have it used to just be the PQ, and now you have the PQ, you have Quebec Solidaire, and you have Option Nationale. So there are three sovereignist parties splitting the vote at the moment, and Quebec Solidaire, for instance, is more like, well, we want to, you know, resolve issues relating to class and poverty, or we want to resolve issues relating to women's rights or gay rights, or we want to resolve issues about the environment, and kind of taking them as separate problems as opposed to taking sovereignty as an issue that would then give us the power to resolve all of those problems. And so the way that you kind of, the way that essentially all of these are issues that need to be dealt with, but the fact that one can trump the other is a problem because they're all intertwined.
Yes.
In real life, anyway.
Yeah. And now, again, is Dr. Jennifer Drouin, Shakespeare in Quebec, Nation, Gender, and Adaptation, University of Toronto Press. And you've been very kind talking to us for an hour, but I've, in the time that we have here, I better ask you to I know your last chapter deals with a different approach, different language in Canada broadly, sea to sea, whatever it is. They say multiculturalism, but in Quebec, it's interculturalism.
Yes.
I know you're a professor. I bet you can explain. What is Quebec's approach?
Interculturalism is was adopted in 1991 by the Bourassa government, actually, not the PQ. And
by the way, he's not popular. The English Canada is very mean about this. I remember Toronto Star hated Bourassa. He's a liberal.
Really?
Go on, I'm sorry.
Yeah, he is a liberal. He doesn't have a very good reputation in Quebec either. But he did adopt the policy of interculturalism in 1991. And interculturalism is essentially kind of halfway between Canadian multiculturalism, which I think everyone will be familiar with, and French republicanism. So in France, for instance, as we've seen just this, like in the past week with the attack on Nice, one of the things that's very important to France is liberty, égalité, fraternité, and part of that égalité and fraternité that you see in France is predicated on la laïcité, because without secularism, their understanding is you can't have equality. And so that's why they're very much focused on secularism in France in order to kind of keep religion out of the public sphere so that you don't know people's religion and therefore everyone is perceived as and treated as equal. So that's the whole kind of banning of niqabs in France versus the whole debate here in English Canada about having a kneecap during a citizenship ceremony, et cetera. And Quebec is interculturalism is essentially halfway between this stance. Not exactly halfway, but it's in the middle of the spectrum. And so the idea is it also has to do with how to integrate diversity into society. So Canadian multiculturalism says, come from wherever you are and bring your culture and be proud of it. And in Toronto, for instance, you have lots of pockets of different communities. Whereas with French republicanism, the idea is you assimilate into French society, you become a French citoyenne, you are Français eventually, and your kind of background is not a race, but you take on French citizenship. And the idea in Quebec is more similar to that in that it's very open to immigration and to immigrants, but the idea is that you have certain fundamental values that in interculturalism are essential to society. And one of those is that the French language is the common language of public life. So if you want to speak Portuguese, I mean, I live not far from Saint Laurent. There's a very large Portuguese community there. That's great. But the language of public life is supposed to be French. And so it's an idea of pluralism that's open to various backgrounds. But the idea is that you still have certain fundamental values, that it's a democratic society, that everyone is expected to participate in society and not isolate themselves off. It's essentially anti-ghetto in a way. You have a Portuguese community, but don't live in a Portuguese ghetto, for instance. Have a Chinese community. There's a Chinatown in downtown Montreal, but speak French and participate in the broader Quebecois society. So that's the way that interculturalism is slightly different from multiculturalism.
Yeah. You did a terrific job. Dr. Jennifer Durand, we are so glad you talked to us. Shakespeare in Quebec, Nation, Gender, and Adaptation. And look forward to talking to you again sometime.
I would love to. Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
We sure enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.